And then I got to a stage where the genre that I was reading in, which was reverse harem, it only had a really small handful of authors writing in it at the time. And I ran out of books to read. And they weren't writing fast enough. So I thought, in the meantime, while I'm waiting, maybe I'll just try and write the book that I want to read.
Welcome to Writes for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest. Hi everyone, Pam here. If the sound is a little weird, I am currently visiting my daughter and grandchildren down in Yass, so I'm recording this particular intro in a bedroom. But I just wanted to pop in quickly to do the intro for this episode, which is a fabulous chat with Tate James, who is a reverse harem author, and along with many other genres, romance, suspense, mystery, a little bit of crime. So Tate writes across genres, but blends all of those things into her very own unique mix of writing, and is doing fabulously in the indie space and now in traditional publishing as well with Bloom Books. So this was a great chat with Tate. It was something new for me to read a reverse harem book, which is basically, if you haven't heard of that, it's when the woman, rather than the man, has multiple partners or choice of multiple partners, as in reverse harem. So I really enjoyed reading the book. It was just something totally different for me. This particular book's name is Hate. It's the first in a Madison Kate series that Tate has written, along with about 41 other books. So she is prolific and just a real dynamo. And I think that whether you're a traditional author or an indie author, there's a lot to learn from this conversation with Tate in terms of her enthusiasm, her inspiration, her kind of take no prisoners attitude in terms of she's just writing the stories that she wants to write and putting them out there and finding readers who are connecting with her ideas, her stories, and her writing. I think that is a great trait that Tate has. So let me tell you a little bit more about Tate before we get into the interview. Tate James is a USA Today bestselling author of fantasy, paranormal, romance, urban fantasy, and romantic suspense. She is a growing force on social media with over 16 million views on hashtag Kate James and 9 million on hashtag Madison Kate as of December 2023. After taking the American market by storm, best-selling author and queen of reverse harem, Tate James is set to seduce Australian readers with her highly anticipated Madison Kate series. Growing up in New Zealand and now living in Australia, Tate's writing has been described as addictive, unpredictable, and engaging. Her stories weave together the best elements of romance, suspense, and mystery genres. Garnering over 25 million views on BookTok, Tate, much like her heroine, MK, is a force to be reckoned with. As I said, great chat with Tate. Lots to learn if whether you're trad or indie, and really interesting to find out about this genre that I previously didn't have much knowledge of. It is Easter this weekend. There is going to be a double episode release. So if you are sitting around and want some great listening, make sure you catch the other release that's coming out this weekend, which is Rachel Johns chatting to fabulously best-selling author Brenda Novak. So make sure you get your earbuds in and your walking shoes on. Sit back, walk, relax, whatever it is you do while you watch or listen to Writes for Women, and have a happy Easter. So Tate James, welcome to Writes for Women.
Thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you here. I haven't chatted to any new adult authors before. I think, is that right? The category that you fall into would be new adult?
Yep, I think so.
Yeah, obviously genres are purely for marketing purposes, but, and I'm sure you have readers that read either side of that. But anyway, I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your books. I've finished reading Hate and it was something really different for me, so keen to chat about that. But can we start with your path to publication, Tate? Have you always wanted to write? And basically, yeah, how did you end up first being published?
Yeah, writing's something I always loved doing as a child and going through school and doing creative writing courses and everything like that. But back in the 90s, that wasn't really a viable career path. And although it was, oh, that's a great hobby, it was never really, that's a career path. It was,
Yeah.
oh, what are you going to do for money? And so I
Exactly.
did fall out of it for a long time and did a real job for a while. And it wasn't until I was had the luxury of time when I was at home on maternity leave with my first child that I rediscovered my love of reading initially and really fell back into the romance reading genre and just devouring books on my Kindle. And then I got to a stage where the genre that I was reading in, which was reverse harem, it only had a really small handful of authors writing in it at the time. And I ran out of books to read, and they weren't writing fast enough. So I thought, in the meantime, while I'm waiting, maybe I'll just try and write the book that I want to read, and that will just pass some time and keep my brain active and give me a little bit of a sense of fulfillment in my day while I'm at home with a newborn who's very
Yeah.
needy and all of the other sort of major life adjustments that came along with that. And then I found that writing the story that I wanted to read really gave me that sort of gave me something to really look forward to that was not dependent on anyone else in my life. And so I really enjoyed it. And so I just kept going with it. And then I found that I finished a 80 something thousand word manuscript, and I made friends with a lot of indie authors along the way, just from being in readers groups on Facebook and things like that. And one of my author friends said to me, "Look, you've done this much. Why don't you try and get it edited and see where it goes?"
Yeah.
So I tried that and it sucked. And
What, the
but
process
you know,
sucked or
editing, it sucks.
Yeah. So you prefer the draft, like getting the story out? Yeah.
But it was my first book, and it was a pretty rough learning curve because I took it to a very thorough, very critical developmental editor, and she just
Ripped it
but
to
I
shreds.
learned a lot, and then I thought, yeah, absolutely tore it to shreds. And then I thought, gosh, I've really learned from this. Let me try again. So I said to her, look, if you're willing to stick with me for book two, I promise I've learned. And she was like, go on then.
To
So
do.
it just, it just snowballed from there. I released it thinking, what harm is there in sharing this with other people? If they don't like it, fuck it.
Yes,
I wrote it for
exactly.
me, not for anyone else. And if they do, great. And it just so happened that they did.
So once it was out there, like how long did it take before you found that people were starting to pick it up and read it and you were getting reviews and feedback and things like that?
I had From spending time as a reader in these communities, I had built enough of a network of readers that I had an ARC team already established who were active in romance groups, and they liked it enough that they really promoted it before release. So I actually found that on release day, I had, I think I hit number 400 in the US store or
Mm,
something.
that's great.
Straight away, I went, I'm onto something. Let's do this.
So did you just then take off and just keep writing? Yeah.
Didn't look back since.
Yeah, brilliant. And so was that initial book part the first of a series and then you kept going with the series? How did that work for you?
Yep, so that first book that I wrote was the first of a six book series called the Kit Davenport series. And so I just kept going with that. And then in between, I started doing a few co-writes with other indie authors and dabbling in some different genres, and yeah, just snowball.
I love it. I love that you just went, bugger it. I'm just going to do this. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I just thought, you know what? I've done the work. What,
Yeah.
like,
Yeah.
let's try it. The worst thing that's going to happen is people are going to go, oh, that really sucks. Oh,
Yeah. And
well.
like you say, you learn with each book, don't you? And you learn as you go along. So, you can only get better. But what was, I mean, you said you were in readers groups already and you obviously were reading a lot yourself. So you were kind of part of that indie world in a way before you even started publishing. But what was the learning curve like for you in terms of actually then publishing the book yourself?
Look, because I was self-publishing it, it wasn't too dramatic.
Hmm.
I had to obviously do my research on how to go about it. And really, it was just other like authors that I had made connections with and made friendships with that just helped me along. They all held my hand and said, this is how you format your document, this is how you set up your KDP file, and so on and so forth. And it was just through, literally through community support that I just figured it all out, and a bit of Dr. Google and
Love Google. So how long ago would that have been, Tate, that your first book came out?
that was September 2017.
Okay. And how many books have you published since then? Have you got a, do you know? Because I had a look on your website. It looks like there's a lot.
45.
Wow. That's amazing. Congratulations. And are they all series?
For the most part, yes. I found really early on that at least 50% of the enjoyment that I get out of writing a book is ending it in a really brutal cliffhanger that I know is going to make people throw their Kindles across a room.
I love
That's
it.
half the fun of it for me. And if I'm writing a standalone, I don't get to do that. And I tried it out recently. I wrote a standalone, a good friend of mine, Heather Long, and it was great writing it. It was a fun process because it was a sort of a Christmas theme one. But we've felt a bit robbed of the opportunity to break hearts and.
Yeah. So make things worse for your characters, and you certainly make things worse for your reader at the end. But they, you will leave them wanting more.
Absolutely.
That's smart, right? So your books seem to be a mashup of kind of romance, mystery, maybe a bit of paranormal and suspense. What drew you to those genres in particular and into combining them? Did you think at any point, oh, I need to stick to a particular genre? Or like you say, you were just writing what you wanted to read and you didn't really care about what genre it fitted into?
No, I never try to fit a genre ever. And if somebody says to me, oh, what genre is your book? Even now I struggle. I'm like, oh, it's a bit of this romance. I just write the story that is percolating in my brain, and whatever other people can use their own opinion as to which genre it fits into. And if it fits into multiple genres, great. If it fits into none, great.
So genres are really a marketing tool anyway, aren't they? Just so you know where to put it in when you upload it to Amazon or how to sell it to readers. So that makes sense. And
Even then, I feel like it's so subjective as to what one person considers to be dark romance, and another person will be like, what? There's nothing dark about that, or so on and so forth. It's a really gray area, unless you're talking, you tried and tested what makes a paranormal or what makes an urban fantasy. Once you get into the nitty-gritty of those subgenres within contemporary, it's all personal opinion at the end of the day.
yeah, absolutely. It's so subjective. And those particular genres, like paranormal and subgenres of that, have huge followings in the indie community, don't they? In that both in terms of people writing them, but
They sure
also
do.
the readership is huge. And it always blows my mind that traditional publishers haven't tapped into that. But you know, what are your thoughts on that kind of thing where you do get a genre like that seems to be so popular in that indie space and yet the traditional publishers shy away from it.
There's no sense to it, is there? I often look at certain genres, like reverse harem is a big genre for, and we go, why? What are they not seeing here that the rest of us are all seeing? It's been very encouraging to see I think just in the last 12 to 18 months, a handful of the trad publishers have really seemed to have made big strides towards what do the readers want? And that's encouraging to see. Whereas I felt like previously, certainly when I first started, they weren't in touch with what the readers were really saying. Hey, we love this. We want to read this. But yeah, some of the newer imprints I feel like they've switched on and they've gone, what do the readers want? We're here to give them what they want.
Yeah, about time too. So you've
Definitely.
mentioned reverse harem. Tell the listenership, because I hadn't actually read any reverse harem books before picking up Madison Kate. So tell us about that trope and what kind of draws you to it. What do you like about writing that?
With RH, I feel like it is very much a case of there's something for everyone within an RH romance. You've got so many different relationship dynamics within the same story, which I think is so exciting because it draws in a much, much broader range of readers. It's not just your, oh, I love the alpha male. Just those readers. Oh, it's an alpha male. Oh, it's not for me. Or, oh, I just love the funny one. Oh, no, I only like assholes. That one's not for me. I feel like by having so many different relationship dynamics, and you can have that combination of, okay, this relationship was a very fast burn, hot, a flash in the pan, instant connection, while that one is a much slower kindle. They're really gonna have to work out their issues to make that work. And having that all within the same storyline, it's almost like a choose your own adventure, but you don't get to choose it. I do. But I think it's just, it's fun. And it, certainly for writing it really keeps you interested because there's so many different characters that are main characters that can really fuck up your plot and just, yeah, cause chaos.
That's right. And that's something that struck me when I was reading Hate, is that kind of opportunity for conflict that you have, because obviously conflict is the main fuel of a plot. So when you've got that kind
Yeah.
of dynamic in those relationships, there's like the internal conflict for your protagonist and the other characters, but then also the external conflict going on between them potentially as well, isn't there?
Yeah. Look, yeah, it gives you some really cool opportunities to explore very human emotions and very realistic reactions in terms of jealousy and possessiveness and acting on impulses and conflict real resolution. It gives you really interesting opportunities to be able to explore, like, how would you resolve this issue?
Yeah, which is great because you're putting the reader into that situation and drawing them into the storyline. What if, what would you do in this situation, like you say, and making the reader really have to think about that. Madison Kate, the Madison Kate series, it is the series, and Madison is the MK is the protagonist there. Tell us a bit about the
Yeah.
series and about Madison herself.
Okay. She's very much a bit of a wild child. She's been raised by a very influential businessman. She, at the start of the series, finds herself in a fairly questionable situation and ends up getting framed for a series of crimes she didn't commit. A bit of repercussion for it before it all gets resolved. And then when she returns a year later, she finds the three, responsible for her framing living in her house,
Yeah, that was a bit of a
forced
surprise.
proximity with them all. Yeah. And there's all kinds of mystery going on. And she has so many questions, but she has so much hatred and resentment for the situation that she ended up in that she cuts her own nose off to spite her face, which only then leads to more and more issues as it goes on with some external threats and dangers surrounding her that she's a little bit too narrow-minded and focused on the threat directly in front of her that she's not seeing the one sneaking up behind her.
And what about her kind of love interests? We've got Steele, Archer, and Kodiak.
Yeah.
Where do you draw inspiration from for your characters when you're creating them? Do they just come to you as you're writing? Do you do character profiles
Yeah.
first? What's your
No,
process?
they entirely flesh themselves out as they get written into the story, and their personality develops in every situation that character is in, and something happens, and they either have to act or react, and what they choose to do defines the character that they end up being.
Yeah, because they're three really different and interesting characters, aren't they? And creating a different kind of dynamic than with MK as well.
Definitely.
So Hate is the first book in the series. How many follow-on books are there so far in that series?
So that series is a four-book series. So it's Hate, Liar, Fake, and Kate. And then there are a couple of, within the same world, essentially, there are a couple of other series that sort of chronologically follow the timeline, but are completely independent series and different characters.
And in terms of creating the world, so this series is set in Shadow Grove, which is the town that MK comes from. She leaves initially at the beginning and then comes back to. How do you go about creating that world?
Look, it creates itself, really. I start with a rough idea of the town setting and a vague picture of it in my mind, and then I give it a name. And a name often helps me think, okay, what kind of industry are they in, and how big is it, and so on and so forth. And then I keep the details vague for a little while, and then often because my editors that I work with and a lot of my beta readers and alpha readers are all based in America, they'll often come to me and be like, this feels like it's in what, Northern California? And I'm like, sure. Yeah, okay. It's if that's what it feels like to you, then that's where it is.
Yeah, I love that.
And
Yeah.
then and I add a little bit more detail after they've come to me with that feedback and flesh it out a little bit from there. But it is just I keep the details quite vague and quite sparse so that it does let the reader sort of form the vague background in their mind because it's not super critical that they know that the coffee shop is beside the bank, which is beside the dog groomers. They don't need to know that. And if they start trying to get those details, then they get caught up in the,
Yeah.
in
No,
the
you don't want
weeds
people
and
coming back to you if you're basing it on a real place, coming back and saying, but yeah, the surf shop isn't there. It's on the next block or whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I found that when I first started writing, what I would do was I would look at a map and I would pick a town or a city. And I would Google Maps it and look at the what it looks like and get a feel for the town. And then I would just misspell it. So
Yeah.
that if anyone did come to me and say, hey, that's not accurate, I'll be like, what are you talking about? This is a made-up town.
I like it. I like the technique. Very clever. So the actual style of your writing, it's really pacey. It's very dialogue based. There's a bit of introspection, but there's a lot of dialogue and there's a lot of kind of action. You've written a lot of books now. Do you feel that you've found your groove with your writing style? And also, I'm really curious as to what your process is. Like when you get your idea, okay, I'm going to start a new book. It's about this character. I'm sitting down. What actually happens for you then? The words just flowing, you're revising as you go. What's your process like?
Look, there's a lot of procrastinating goes into it. I do find that I'm very much a pressure cooker. So until I absolutely have to get the words on paper, it just floats around in my brain,
Right.
which it's part of the
That's
process
good. That's
because
good. Yeah.
the more it floats around in your brain, the more grasp you have of your character and your setting and your villains and your overarching plot and all the rest of it. Once I actually absolutely have to put words on paper, I do a lot of self-bullying to make it happen. I'm a great distraction to myself, so I have to set up sprint like word sprints using
Right.
O-Write. I use a program called O-Write.
Oh, okay. Tell us a bit about that.
O-H-Write. It was actually developed by a friend of mine, Cadence Snow. She's an author as well. She's an indie author from Melbourne. Her husband, John, is a web developer. And a few years back, when we used to use a different program, I can't even remember what it was called for our writing sprints, it was very glitchy and quite unreliable to the point where there were too many instances where we lost words and like
Yeah, you
losing
don't want to be
words is
losing
like,
words. Yeah.
yeah, losing words is like spilling breast milk. No. So we said to John one day, please help us out, build us a reliable sprint system that we can use. It's in your own benefit because your wife will also produce more books. And then I will stop being so annoying and asking you to build this system. So we bullied him into it.
Fair
And
enough.
he's built this incredible system called O-Write where you can set up your own sprint rooms. You can invite friends to come and work with you. And essentially, you write in your own document. Nobody sees your word, they just see your word count, which allows your friends and accountability partners to go, hey, that word count hasn't changed in half an hour. Are you even at your desk?
Are
So,
you on your phone?
yeah, exactly. I can see you on Instagram. Get some words down. So I feel like somehow breaks the divide from that sort of solo environment where it's just us forcing ourselves to do work that we're only answering to ourselves for,
Yeah.
which is, it's hard. It's hard to do depending on your work style. I personally find it very hard to do. So unless I have one of my friends blowing up my phone at 8 o'clock in the morning being like, I will see you in 45 minutes, no excuses, then, I'm going to mess around until 10 a.m.
Yeah, I'm hearing you. I do the same. Yeah. So once you get your bum in the seat and you're in the zone, are you pretty fast in terms of getting the words down once you are in that story zone?
No, I'm hopeless. I type really slowly. I finger type as well,
Okay.
which is just shocking, but it is what it is. Can't teach an old dog new tricks. But I do clean draft.
Right.
The manuscript or the final product that I put out is very similar to my first draft. I don't often go back and revise. I don't do much self-edit because I've learned over the years that I don't like doing that. So
Right.
how am I going to reduce the jobs that I don't like doing to keep this job enjoyable for myself. So one of the things that I have taught myself to do is clean draft, write the way I want it presented. So that although my word count per day is significantly lower than the likes of my good friend Jamie and Eve that I usually sprint with, the difference is that I then don't have to spend 2 weeks going back and rewriting. I send that straight to my editor when I'm done. Okay. So it all balances out in the wash.
Yeah. And like when you're doing that procrastinating and thinking, you're building the story in your head. So it's coming out.
That's it. And often I'll even have entire sort of scenes with dialogue going on in my brain. And that really makes me sound crazy. As I'm in the shower washing my hair, I'll be thinking through, okay, the first couple of chapters, like the first couple of paragraphs of that chapter, what exactly is happening? What are they saying to each other? Where are they positioned in the room? Is one of them sitting? Is one of them standing? If they're standing, what are they doing with their arms? Are they just flopping around? Are they crossed? Like things like that. That I think about when I'm not at my desk, so that when I do sit down, I can just put it on paper.
Yeah, it's all part of the process, isn't it? And do you work to deadlines?
Yes, I have to set myself deadlines or I just won't do it.
Yeah. And what would be the average time for you to produce, say, a book like Hate in terms of writing it out and then before you send it to your editor?
About 2 months.
And then when it's coming back to you from the editor, do you usually find that you have much work to do or you've refined the process down?
There's very little to be done. Like when I get my edits back, I can turn them around in 1 to 2 days.
Brilliant. Yeah. So then, Tate, is it then a matter for you of do you do the kind of uploading and stuff like that yourself? And also I was going to talk to you about your cover art, how you organise all that. Because I think that there would be a lot of people listening to the podcast and just from talking to different people in the writing community who often are thinking, do I continue down this road of trying to get a trad deal? Do I attempt the indie thing? How hard is it? So in terms of like once you've done the writing, what are the other steps that you have to then go through?
You need to have a content and developmental editor that can be going through it and picking up any plot holes or inconsistencies and things like that, that you can iron out before you get too deep down the rabbit hole. You need to have a good line, like copy and line editor. And I personally think that they should be different people so that they are completely different. They're different skills. They're different specialties. And it's unrealistic to expect one person to be the best at both of those. Mm. So hire a great content and developmental editor and hire a great line and copy editor.
Yeah.
And never the two shall meet. But at least then you've got two very different sets of analytical eyes on your manuscript. Then have a handful of trusted, critical beta readers that can not necessarily comb through for errors, although if you're so inclined, grab errors as well. But mainly just to get that overall the initial reaction of how it's going to land with readers.
Yeah.
Or anything that you might have just missed or your editors have missed that can comb through and just clean it up that little bit more. And then you have to take a leap.
Yeah.
At that stage, you have to go, if I keep looking at this, I will never release it.
Yeah.
So you have to just cut ties. You've got to then format your ebook, get your cover art, write a blurb, and get it loaded. Get it done, get it out there.
Yeah. So you would by now, I imagine, have preferred cover designers and things like that as part of your kind of usual team?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And once you find a good one, hold on to them.
Yeah, because it's such a great skill, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah. And it's so valuable. And a cover can make and break a book. The old saying is don't judge a book by its cover, but we do. Mm. Everyone does. It's normal. It's a marketing hook. A great cover is going to entice readers before they even get to the blurb.
And do you brief your cover designers on what you think you'd like to see, or are you just totally handing it over to them and saying, do what you will?
No, I'm usually fairly specific with what I want, although I do tend to, I'm wondering if I have any examples around me. I do tend to do stick drawings.
Okay.
of what I want the cover to look like. So I do little stick drawings of the composition that I want. If I'm asking them to start from scratch, I'll say, look, this is where I see typography and I want a dead girl in a pool of blood down here and put some trees here and so on and so forth. And most of the time, my designers are like, yep, I know what you're talking about. And they just make it happen. For the original Madison Kate covers, I had purchased some pre-made covers from a fantastic cover designer that had loaded, she does pre-made cover.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, great, I could write a story for that. It was before I'd ever come up with the concept for Madison Kate. And the original cover was a young girl wearing a hat just sitting against a wall, and she had this long pink hair. And then I started writing the book and I went, oh, that cover does not match this book. Like, it was just, the cover screamed YA high school.
Yeah.
And it just, it didn't match. So then I went back on the hunt, and that's when I started buying exclusive photography for my covers. So then a lot of my covers would, the jumping off point would be whatever image I'd purchased to represent a character or something. And so then I would just send the images to my designer and say, here's the title, here's the model, go.
Right. I love that. So you were using those images for inspiration for the writing.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. So Madison Kate series has been out for a while and it's been revamped. Like, what's the kind of story around that?
Yeah, so it's the print rights were purchased by Bloom, which is a sort of imprint of Sourcebooks. So they've created their own covers for it, but essentially nothing has changed with the storyline itself. The only difference is that I've put a bonus chapter into the end of each of the print editions now, just to something new.
Yeah, they're really striking covers. I actually thought I had mine with me, but I haven't brought it over to the recording studio that I'm in. The great bright green hate. The hot pink bit of hair, it really is eye-catching, and then replicating that for the rest of the series.
Yeah, the cool thing about those covers is that if you line the series up side by side, the hair matches. And if you line them up spines together, the hair matches.
Oh, that's brilliant. That is so good. I love that. That's very clever. How did the deal with Bloom come about? Like, you're obviously on a roll with your whole indie publishing and getting books out, I guess, primarily in digital form, is that right?
Yes, I've always had my books as paperback, but they have always been print on demand.
Yep.
What I was finding was that although in the recent sort of year or so, there have been a handful of stores, mostly within America or strangely through the Middle East, that have picked up my books in print to put in the shops, it was the exception, not the rule, that they would take indie authors. And it was after speaking with a bookstore here in Australia about, like, why don't you stock more indie authors, that they actually showed me the numbers against it. And the price that they have to purchase at compared to the percentage of markup that they have to put on it, which then equates to the per book copy costing so much that Australian readers aren't going to pay it.
Yeah.
So it was once I understood that kind of back-end breakdown of why indie books aren't sitting in Australian bookstores that I went, okay, so if I want my physical books to be on the shelves in Big W, in Kmart, in Dimex, in QVD, it has to be with a trad publisher. Yep. That's the only way to get that cost low enough to be affordable to go into these stores so that readers can actually buy them at an affordable price. Because even my indie copies, to buy them in Australia, you're looking at $30 a book for a paperback. And there was nothing I could do about that. That was just the price. And living here and seeing the availability of books and the cost of everything, I was just like, I gotta try something. And it just, it just worked out that a friend of mine was, I think she was at a signing or a conference or something, and she ran into, she knows a couple of the editors from Bloom and was like, you have to read this book, you have to.
Oh, great.
Read it right now, I'll stand here and watch you. And it just, it worked out, they liked it. So
that's excellent. So you've still got your digital platform, but then it's going to be, they're more widely available, like you say, for readers to get in traditional stores. So that's amazing.
Yeah
Have you done any audio work, audio books?
Yep All of my titles are available in audio.
That's fantastic. How do you organise that yourself?
I do it through a company called Audio Sorceress, which is owned by Marnie Young. She was my very first female narrator that I used on the Kit Davenport series, and I hired her just from ACX auditions.
Yeah.
And then I worked with her on that series, and then shortly thereafter, she said to me, "Oh, I'm thinking of starting my own production company. Would love to work with you." So then, when I had the next opportunity to create an audio, I turned to her and said, "Can you help me out?" And given the choice, I would never work with another production company. She's been fantastic for me. She does exactly what I want on audio. They go really above and beyond on creating more of a cinematic kind of experience on the audiobook as opposed to just a book being read by a narrator.
Okay.
They use, sound effects, and they really, their narrators are coached properly. Not, the narrators won't know what they're doing, but they are coached in terms of use inflection. If the line is supposed to be whispered, whisper it. So little things like that really changed the whole vibe of the audiobook.
Yeah, because the narrator can make or break it, can't they?
Absolutely. Yeah.
The way
Yeah.
that we're read. So, how do you find the whole marketing side of things, Tate? Is that something that you took to straight away, or was it is a little bit more of a challenge? I know a lot of authors find that side of the business really difficult. So, how do you approach the whole marketing side and the social media side of things?
Oh, it's horrific. I hate it. I'm so bad at marketing. Honestly, I've never felt so millennial as I have trying to navigate social media. Like, it's just, I never considered myself to be old until I tried to social media.
It just gets worse with age,
It
believe me.
gets so bad. I really tried with TikTok during COVID. I was like, yes, this platform's really working for authors. The BookTok community is really responsive. It's going to be great for books. I couldn't do it.
Oh, really?
Everything I tried to do was just, I would watch it back and be like, this is awful. Like, I feel mum crashing a teenager's party and trying to join in. I was like, some people have got it. Some people have got it down. And I have seen some authors that have just soared on TikTok, and hats off to them, but
Oh,
it's not
100%. Yeah. Are you still on TikTok? Do you still do stuff on TikTok or?
no, I have an account and I scroll it endlessly late at night when I'm not supposed to be on social media, but I very rarely post anything myself anymore. I'll see what people have tagged me in and I'll respond to them and I'll comment and things like that, but I can't dance, I can't sing, I'm not very funny. It's just, it's not for me. It's not my platform. Facebook, I'm great at.
Okay. And what about Instagram? Do you like Insta?
Don't like Instagram
No.
as well. I found it very similar to TikTok, and I found that there's a lot of algorithm ins and outs and rules and tricks and tips, and it was just so overwhelming. And I just went, I don't have the mental capacity to take all of this on and master it all, as well as write books. So I've accepted the things that I cannot change, and I've got people on my team who help with these things. So I have an incredible assistant who essentially runs my Instagram for me in terms of posting the right image in the right order with the right filter. And it's like, I just, and if I go rogue and post something without asking her, she's just,
Stop.
what have you done? I'm sorry.
And do you do the, in terms of connecting with your readers, do you do any of the kind of big book fairs or the reader conferences and things? I know that's a big part of some of the, a lot of the indie kind of in that indie space. I've been to a couple of them and it just blows my mind that these readers rock up with like suitcases full of books for the authors to sign, or they take home suitcases full of books that they've bought. How's your experience of that sort of thing
No,
been?
they're incredible. I actually really enjoy going to big signing events, and I think that for me, I'm in the unique position where I am an extroverted person, and that is rare amongst authors. A majority of authors that I've ever met are very introverted, and they find those big social situations daunting and very draining, whereas I really look forward to them. And for me, it's a highlight of my year to be able to go to big signings. So I always try to incorporate them into my calendar, even though my husband is not super impressed with my calendar this year, but
Sounds like you've got a few things on.
I do. So I've got, so this year I'm going over to the US in June for Book Bonanza.
Great.
And then I'm in September, I've got Rare in Edinburgh. Two
Oh,
quite
fantastic.
big trips.
Tax deductible, so that's fine. 100%.
Absolutely, it's work. But I love having that at least once a year, being able to yeah, meet people face to face, and actually it feels a little bit more real when people in the flesh as opposed to just a name on a screen. And it's also quite surreal when, particularly in America, when you have people come up to you at the signing and you recognize their name from people that you've been talking to on in Facebook groups for years, and you go, oh my God, that's, it's like you're a real person.
Amazing. There's a
But
real
no,
kind of camaraderie, isn't there, between the reader, those really devoted readers who do attend those sorts of things, but also in those online groups. And I think social media, and particularly like Facebook groups and things like that, has really allowed that connection between reader and writer, hasn't it?
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think it can have its negative drawbacks. I think that there have been a lot of times since I started writing that we've seen the sort of the wave of attitudes and entitlement that really it walks the line of authors being a little too accessible, that people forget that they're talking to a real person, that they forget that their words have actions, have consequences. And there's definitely a very thin line there between interacting and appreciating and being accessible to answer questions and letting, readers feel very connected with stories and with the author themselves. And then just that tiny step over into getting your feelings really hurt.
Invading your personal space and time, isn't it?
And then, yeah, taking that little bit step too far and thinking that they have ownership over your time and being offended if you haven't replied for 24 hours and things like that, which I think is, it's a social media issue in itself, not necessarily just in book world, but it's a tough one that you have to navigate on a daily basis.
So how would you describe your typical reader, Tate? Who the person that would go and say pick up Hate or Fake or any of your other series? Like, what are the sort of characteristics that you think they have in common, those readers?
Do you know what? From doing in-person signing events, I have realized that I don't have a typical reader.
Okay,
Like,
interesting.
I have met the broadest range of readers that are all big enough fan that they have traveled and paid for a ticket to come and meet me at an event. And the range is enormous, from your late teens, early 20-year-old girls, all the way up to, I've got gay men, straight men, all the rest of it, husbands that their wives have been like, oh, you should read this, you might enjoy it. And they've gone, actually, I did enjoy that. Up to readers who could be my grandparents, and they all enjoy the same books, which is, it's a bit surreal.
It's really interesting though, isn't it, when you think about that, because it shows how, as human beings, we just have that love for story and character development and all the conflict and the plot elements that go along with that, which are really there in your book.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. So what's next? What are you currently working on?
I'm working on a new book at the moment that is yet unannounced, but it is something that I'm writing for my traditional publisher. So I'm working on that. And then once I finish this one, I will be working on another co-write book with Jame and Eve, which we're both very excited to get into. We've been talking about the storyline for probably since we finished our last co-write, and we've just been trying to find out the time to line our schedules up. Yeah, there's a few balls in the air at the moment.
And you were saying that the Madison Kate series is available in trad stores. So if people are listening and they'd like to get hold of that, can they go along to, say, Big W or go to their local bookshop and order it in? What would you advise?
Absolutely, yeah. Big W, Kmart, Dimmicks, and QBD. I've seen it at Harry Hartog's. I'm not sure about any of the other. But yeah, it should be available anywhere you buy books.
And is that whole series available now?
I think book four releases on the 19th.
So by the
And
time
then,
this comes out, yeah, they'll all be out, which is fantastic.
yes. Yeah. And then the follow-on series called Hades releases, I think, in August.
Okay, fantastic. Whereabouts can people find you online, Tate?
Online, the best place to find me is my readers group on Facebook. It is called The Foxhole.
Great. I'll put the link to that in the show notes.
But don't ask me why. It's a name that I picked way back before I started writing, and now I'm stuck with it. So That is my most active platform, but otherwise I'm on all the other social medias as Tate James Author.
Great. And the question I often like to finish with, Tate, sometimes slips people up, but just go with whatever is comes to the top of your head, is what would you say is at the heart of your writing?
Oh gosh, I think at the heart of my writing is probably creating characters and dialogue that is authentic to my own sort of values and personality to some extent. It's creating a safe understanding that it's okay for women to be outspoken and have a spine and challenge authority and so on and so forth, that I like to think of as in my own little way, progressing the feminist movement through romance literature, which is not always the most feminist of genres to read. So, yeah, I always like to look at challenging traditional status quo of what makes a romance novel.
I love that. I've really enjoyed reading the book, and it's been great to chat to you. I look forward to seeing some more of your books out there and to getting hold of them. So, all the best with it.
Awesome. Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Rights for Women. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with this week's guest. If you did, I'd love it if you could add a quick rating or review wherever you get your podcasts so others can more easily find the episodes. Don't forget to check out the backlist on the Rights for Women website. So much great writing advice in the library there. And you can also find the transcript of today's chat on the website too. You can find details on the website on how to support the podcast through Patreon, and you can connect with me through the website at rightsforwomen.com, on Instagram and Twitter at W4WPodcast, the Facebook page Rights for Women, or find me and my writing at pamelacook.com.au. Thanks for listening, have a great week, and remember, every word you write, you're one word closer to typing the end.